Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Guru, Deity, Protector, Part 3.
Essentially, confident faith is described as the feeling of solidity that comes from a rational appreciation. That is, you study the stuff, you think about it, it makes sense. So you say, okay, I'll give it a try. And this is one of the reasons why I like Buddhist practice and Buddhist perspective, is because it actually does make sense. Christianity, for instance, doesn't. And the consequence of that is that faith as a practice in Christianity is actually it has to be stronger because it doesn't make sense. And it's not just Christianity, actually, it applies to most of the Abrahamic traditions, because somehow or other they ended up with a problem. And the problem was, if there is an all-loving, almighty God, why do we suffer? The problem of pain, which C.S. Lewis wrote about. Buddhism, on the other hand, but it says, you know, there is suffering. Where we start, so it's not, its existence isn't regarded as a problem, it's regarded as a fact. No explanation required. There it is. And so a rational appreciation is for many people an important step, a starting point. And I know this from my work with people who are not particularly into spiritual stuff. You know, want to get them to do something. It's got to make sense to them, because they're not going to do it out of clear appreciation or longing or anything. Okay. Other questions, Deborah.
Along that same training, is confidence also experiential in experiencing the effectiveness of what the teacher is transmitting?
Well, I think more than what the teacher is transmitting, it's effectiveness in your own experience. So, person X says, well, if you do this, you may experience why, and so you go out and you say, oh, I'll give this a try. And lo and behold, you do experience why. Now you have a rational basis for trusting what person X says. You follow? And you have a rational basis for doing X in the future, because it actually did produce why. Other questions?
You have to have self, you appreciate yourself and love yourself before you get into having the confidence to, you know, the things of that.
I don't think so.
Thinking of that vipassana, self-love, and the children.
Well, in Tibetan, and I really doubt, I don't know Pali that well enough, but I really doubt in Pali, and certainly not in Tibetan, in Sanskrit to my knowledge, the idea of self-love or self-compassion is a contradiction in terms. And the we have these concepts in flying around, really, because of the influence of Western psychology. In Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, the wish to that others be free of suffering is called compassion. You want others to be free of suffering, that's compassion. The wish that you be free of suffering is not called self-compassion. It's called renunciation. Or, if you want to take another translation, it's called determination. I want to be free in some, I got to do something about it. I got to get out of this mess. And so, that is the wish that I want to be free of suffering, is disenchantment with the current state of affairs, etc., etc., which leads to that renunciation. And the capacity to be present with your own pain, that's not self-compassion. That's mindfulness. That's what mindfulness is. Just that. I tend to feel, and this may be a bit harsh on my side, that wouldn't be the first time, that these concepts, such as self-love, self-compassion, self-forgiveness, are often covert or not so covert ways of protecting a very explicit sense of self that does not want to meet the actual state of affairs. Well, you could describe it, but it's a protective mechanism, usually centered around a very explicit sense of self. Okay.
But Ken, in doing mind training, it seems to me that part of that is compassion for yourself and doing that with your own pain.
It's accepting the pain. What do you mean compassion with yourself?
Sending yourself light, or taking in the pain.
Yes, but when we're doing that, we're doing it with a very explicit conception of self. And the purpose of it is to undo that particular conception. For instance, it's a instruction I give to people. They have a piece from their childhood, say, where something very uncomfortable, very painful happened, maybe some form of abuse or something like that. And I will instruct people to say, you do taking and sending with that channel. What they're doing taking and sending with is something that is locked inside them. And by doing that with it, they're actually opening that up and experiencing what's in there. And when they experience it completely, that literally dissolves. And now they're free, because not necessarily from the pain, but from having to avoid it.
And it's almost like an objective. You're looking at that part of you.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it because the way you're relating it to it inside is like it's another.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you're doing the taking and sending retreat last year, you know, anything that you feel a sense of other with is appropriate to be taking and sending. Okay. Which I feel is different from like trying to feel compassion for yourself, whatever that is. The other problem I have is there isn't any self to feel compassion for. People don't like that.
Well, me, there's there another.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Now, this afternoon, and if someone could keep an eye on the time, so I left my clock down below, and let me know at about 5:15, you know, wave something frantically, throw pens, whatever. Not dark. Pens will be fine. I want to continue on with the bit about Guru. This morning, I said, you take a person as a symbol, and that person can be living or dead. In the Tibetan tradition, you're generally encouraged to take a living person, but it's not a yidam. It's not a protector. You can't take yidam or protector as a guru. They serve different functions, and we'll be getting to those. And the reason it's a person is because you can have a relationship with a person. And that's why a living person is sometimes better. Because then you can definitely have a relationship. And the point here, a relationship with another person is primarily emotional. And the purpose here is to form an emotional relationship with what is ultimately true. Now, much of the time when we're discussing what is ultimately true, it's an idea. Now, it's like trying to have an emotional relationship with an equation. There are a few mathematicians that do that, but That's another story. So the guru is primarily a person who is for you a symbol of what is ultimately true. And I think this is what is meant, or part of what is meant anyway, when you get this, you think of your guru as the Buddha, regard the guru as the Buddha. Now, a relationship consists of two people relating to each other. And for that relationship to be maintained, Okay, go ahead.
I've heard it said by other Tibetan teachers that situations in life can be like a guru, so when you have a relationship with something that's got personality or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What's the question?
So the question is that the case, that situations can be gurus, or am I being too literal when I say that?
In those situations, they're really speaking metaphorically. For instance, a Serlingpa at the end of Great Path of Awakening, quotes a number of verses, says, adverse conditions are spiritual friends. And he explains this by saying that they do the same things as a spiritual friend does. You know, challenge you to be patient, bring out your compassion, put you in touch with your internal material, etc., etc., etc. So one can use, and it's very good, to use the situations in life to learn from. But that isn't the same thing as having a relationship with a person who is a teacher. Okay? Now, relationship depends on balance. That is, one is receiving from, one is putting into the relationship commensurate to what is one is receiving from the relationship. And if that isn't happening, then the relationship inevitably moves out of balance, and a relationship cannot survive moving into a permanent state of imbalance. It always leads to problems and eventually dissolution of the relationship. How is the guru-student relationship balanced? Well, I think it's instructive to look at the parent-child relationship. One of the imbalancing processes which is very prevalent in our culture is that a large number of parents expect their children to return what the parents are putting into the relationship. In other words, they create a demand for attention from the child. This totally screws the child up every time. Right? We're all the walking wounded here. The way that relationship is balanced is that the child, when he or she has children, provides the same kind of attention that they receive from their parent. So balancing a relationship doesn't necessarily mean a direct balancing. So as with the parent-child relationship, there's a kind of generational understanding in the student-teacher relationship. Attention flows from the teacher to the student. The teacher does not place an emotional demand, a demand for emotional attention on the student. That's not the demand that the teacher places on the student. The teacher places all sorts of other demands, but not that one. And the student receives instruction, guidance, presence, all this kind of stuff, and passes that on. That's how the relationship is balanced. Did you have a question, Jessica?
Well, I was just going to say, it assumes the maturation of the parent for the teacher in that transmission.
Exactly. Which doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
But we can be a little idealistic from time to time. But I want to go a little further into the guru-student relationship. There's a great deal of propaganda about this too. And I think it's what I'd like to do for a few minutes is to look at the guru-student, some of the protocols that are described, presented around the guru-student relationship, as a way of handling a relationship between two people in such a way that the inevitable transference, emotional reaction kind of stuff doesn't disrupt the intention of the relationship. Now, one has the instruction, you regard the guru as the Buddha, and many people interpret this, and I would say naively, to mean you have to look at the guru as being perfect in every way. In my mind, the guru-student relationship marks a maturation in the student, and a maturation in the relationship. Nobody's perfect. I described this cigar-smoking, stone-throwing monk. Kala Rinpoche greatly enjoyed snuff. I remember when we were preparing to leave India to come on Rinpoche's first tour, one of Rinpoche's students brought him in this box. It's all wrapped up. And Rinpoche opened it up. It contained about 30 boxes of snuff. And Rinpoche went, "Oh, that was very kind of him." Chimi Rinpoche in England is quite a good teacher, quite eccentric. He can't sit still for 5 minutes. He's always running off and doing something. And, Pauling is like trying to pin down mercury. I mean, everybody has their foibles. The instruction is a way of, or the guru-student relationship is viable when a student has reached the point through knowing the teacher, knows that the teacher isn't perfect, has those foibles, and chooses to use his or her own reaction to those foibles as material for their own practice. So there's no sense of ignoring here. That's what I mean about a maturing in the student. They've reached that point in their practice that, well, my guru wants to take snuff, that's his business. My guru wants to do that, that's her business. Doesn't actually disrupt the spiritual intention, the transmission intention, the intention for the student to become awake. So when the student adopts that attitude, they're no longer critical of their teacher because they're going to work internally with whatever arises. It also represents a maturation in the relationship. A maturation in which the student now knows that whatever the teacher does, the teacher is actually, in terms of their relationship, only concerned with the student's waking up and is not going to use the student for personal gain of any kind, getting emotional needs met, affection, sex, power, money, influence, whatever. That is, the student's hung around long enough to know that is the case. Again, that's a maturation in the relationship. And on the other side, the teacher knows the student well enough to know that the student is now capable of using whatever comes up for practice. Now, when you look at it this way, it actually just makes a lot of sense. It's not particularly magical or mysterious, and it doesn't involve a lot of denial of power, etc., etc. And it's quite possible that something may happen, teacher may do something, and the student's going to go, you know, I can't live with that one. That's and there's something wrong. And they'll take it up with the teacher, and if it can't be worked out, then the guru-student relationship comes to an end. Because the guru-student relationship means being able to use whatever arises in the relationship internally. And when that happens, you know, in many cases, it's because the teacher has violated the relationship. That is, the teacher has sought to get something from the student. That violates the relationship. Attention goes from the teacher to the student. You know, the teacher can be recompensed, you know, in terms of money or support or something like that. That's reasonable. There. But anything above that, the teacher has no claim to whatsoever. Because in that, it's a shared aim relationship, and the aim of the relationship is the student's awakening. Nothing else. Robert, do you have a question?
Yes. Isn't what you're saying really go to the equality that you were talking about earlier? It's really what the bargain is between the student and his teacher.
Yeah.
Namely, the three responsibilities of the teacher and the two responsibilities of the student. That's the bargain. That's what makes it equal.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But what I'm doing is going through some of the traditional formulations of this, which have created a certain amount of confusion in certain quarters. Or is that putting too small a label on it? Pardon?
Yeah.
Very good. Yes. But have created widespread angst, anguish, tragedy, and turmoil. Whatever. Now, what time do you have?
5 minutes.
Okay, that's good. A few points about your practice, and then open it up for questions. You're going to be better off, generally speaking, regarding for having an actual relationship with a teacher, i.e. a living person. It's more challenging. That's precisely because there's more to work there in the relationship. And I go back to what Robert just referred to a few moments ago. That person has those three responsibilities. And the relationship matures, or can mature, into a guru-student relationship when you, as a student, are completely confident that the teacher is only concerned with your awakening, and that everything he or she does is directed to that end. That's one thing. And secondly, you are prepared to use your own reactions to whatever he or she may do as fuel for your own practice. Those are the characteristics which make it into a guru-student relationship. On the teacher's side, it's a guru-student relationship when the student is prepared to do that, and the guru is prepared and trusts that the student is prepared to do that. The guru doesn't trust the student to be able to do that. The relationship doesn't come together. Yes?
Is there a finality to that?
There can be.
Or is it just an unspoken other?
There can be a formality, but most of the time it's it is actually a process of evolution. They find themselves there. Now, Vajrayana initiation was often taken as a way of formalizing that step. And of course, as we all know, people jump into their idea of the guru-student relationship and it's based totally on paternal and sometimes romantic projections. And with the usual predictable consequences. Okay. So, in your practice, I talked this morning about the three kinds of faith. I want to go a little bit further into those. I link them up with the three poisons. They're also linked quite directly with the three marks of existence. Or actually, it's a little fairer to say with the three doors of freedom, which are no characteristics, no aspirations, and emptiness. No characteristics, no aspirations, or no wishes, actually, and emptiness. Now, let's take the first one, clear open appreciation. When you experience that clear open appreciation, and I know many of you have some experience of that, who are you? Yeah? Yeah. You're nobody. You're empty. Non-self. Emptiness. Okay. Consequently, in terms of your practice, if you're working with that form of faith, you're going to feel like you're falling. Fall. Just fall. That's the practice. You have that clear, open appreciation. There's no reference there. There's no up. There's no down. There's nothing to hold on to. Fall.
Just like falling in love. Just falling.
Yeah, except there's that little. We'll get to that. Longing. This, of course, is connected with suffering. Is also connected, that's the mark of existence. It's also connected with no wishes. Now, when you start letting yourself feel that longing, for peace, for purity, for whatever, all of these other longings come tagging along and say, can I get some too? You know, want this, want that. And so you're going to find all of these longings coming with it. And those are the source of our suffering. Those are our emotional needs. Right? The way to work with this in practice, experience all of it. All of them. Which gets pretty intense. You may feel as if your heart is going to break for that kind of longing. Good. Let it break. Break totally and completely. The old cliche. A broken heart is an open heart. Very important. And the heart's broken because as you feel all of those old longings, you know, when you feel them deeply enough, you know none of them can be fulfilled. And so your heart breaks. With confident faith, this is connected to no characteristics, which is the extrapolation of impermanence. It starts off with a nice rational appreciation. Yeah, this makes sense. This makes sense. This makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. But then you have to go the next step. And one steps back at that point. Because that's where the confidence has to come in. And so this form of faith, when you first work with it, feels like a rational appreciation, but you quickly find yourself stepping into unknown territory where there are no characteristics. There's actually nothing to hold on to. I'm just going to go there. So each of these have described a way that you work the edge. You work the edge of the clear open appreciation by falling. You work the edge of longing by letting your heart break. And you work the edge of confidence by just going the next step. Well, you went this far. Take the next step. In terms of how you do this, I really recommend you work deeply with these. Certainly don't do more than 2.5-hour section. I would actually think you'd find it probably more fruitful to work with one in each half-hour section. Ten.
But we should definitely work with all three at some point.
At some point, work with all three, just so that you have the flavor of it. But you're going to, and you haven't already done that, then make sure you do that this evening, because we'll have this evening and then tomorrow morning, and then we're going to move on to another set of facts. But so have this some experience with all three, and then to work with the one that you resonate with most strongly is fine to do. Okay, Devin.
I'm not clear on the confidence. What would an example of the next step be that you might not want to take? I'm not clear on that relates to the goal.
Well, does practicing meditation make sense to you? You practice every day? There's your next step.
Well, how can I do that in a half an hour?
What comes up when you think of taking that next step? There it is. That's just one example. That's once enough. Janneke?
It's 5:17.
Yeah, thank you. 15.
Oh. You guys do get out. What's your question?
The other thing is, does it matter where you sit?
No.
Ken?
Yes.
I'm confused because I can't really separate the three. They're so intricately related to me. I mean, that's like saying, well, you know, look at the primary colors. I mean, you were hitting.
What color is that?
It's red.
Thank you.
Okay. To me, this process, though, is not, at least in my mind, it's not intellectual. It's not cognitive.
Absolutely, it's emotional.
It's completely emotional. Mm-hmm. So when you say, look at red, well, that's not emotional.
Do you know the experience of clear open appreciation?
Uh-huh.
Fall. Okay? Do you know the experience of longing? You know the experience of longing.
Okay.
Do you?
Well, yes, while I'm falling.
Yes, that's fine. But then you focus on letting your heart break.
Okay.
Okay. And yes, they're all intertwined. That's very, and really these are just, I say
different ways of looking at the same thing, isn't it?
No, not completely. But they're very much, they play off each other and so forth. And part of my intention here is so that you get a really clear experience of each. And now, on the basis of that, you'll be able to experience all three more fully.
All right.
Okay. Josephine and Dan, and then we'll do the prayer. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I sort of had a similar experience when I tried to do this, that I would think that I should start with a particular kind of faith, and I would find as I tried to move into that experience that I was wrong, that there was a different kind of faith happening there, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I assume that's fine, but that, I mean, that I think is what you're talking about.
Right. Right?
Well, there are a couple of things that can be happening there.
Yeah.
One is, okay, I'll work with this, and this little reactive mechanism says, no, we're not going to go there. Let's go here instead. This is easier.
Well, I tried to stay with it for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I didn't move into it. I just noticed that it would naturally bring up for me that I had this idea about myself that wasn't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to trying to work with it.
Which kind of faith were you working with?
Well, I started with the one I thought would be easiest for me. Which would be longing.
Longing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it brought up an idea of yourself.
Well, yeah, that was
fascinatingly. Pardon?
Well, yes.
And what does that idea of yourself want?
I wanted to move to a different meditation.
Yeah, but what did it mean?
Or give it up altogether.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. What does that idea of yourself, what does it want?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that, but what I got when I just sort of heard myself say that was that actually I'm afraid of falling into how much longing I might have.
Exactly.
So.
That's it. That's right. Good. Yeah.
I'm not exactly clear. The practices of these three types of faith and what you've said about the guru-student relationship.
Oh. This is in joining your mind with a guru. This is how you do it. What separates us from from being one with the guru's mind, number one, is the sense that we're separate. So you fall. Okay. Secondly, is we want something. And when we feel very, very deeply that wanting, that's going to be exploded. And now we can actually join. And the thing is, the third is, we're trying to understand something. But that's the intellect offering. And when we take that next step, we drop into non-intellect. So each of these three forms of faith is a way of joining with the guru's mind. And don't forget, the guru's mind is Dharmakaya, what is. And we're using the guru as a symbol of it. Does that answer your question?
As you know, in this tradition, there's very formal, visualizations and all of this, which this is contained.
Yes.
Okay. You have not presented that to me.
That's right.
I'm not saying you should.
No, but I'm trying to give the flavor. And what most of us did way back then is we did the formal stuff and we kind of happened on this stuff in the process.
Okay,
and in the same way that I taught Chenrezig last year, what I'm trying to do is give you the essence,
mm-hmm.
what it's actually about. And then those who choose this as a path then they can engage the formal practices. But then they'll, I hope, know what they're doing.
Okay.
That's the way I'm approaching it.
Mm.
All right, let's turn to... Yes. Please.
Just for edification, the Qigong, George leads the Qigong practice, so we can all fall in line with him and watch him for 3 weeks. George is not in the room. Gail, look for Gail.
Okay.
Who is Gail?
Okay, we'll do the Vajradhara prayer, the second refuge prayer, and then the fulfilling intention prayer on page 25.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.